Malden. Chapter 1. Thousands of people stood on the Mystic River Bridge and watched as everything between Com Ave and Boston Harbor took fire and burned. The wind from the west remained brisk and warm even after the sun was down, and the flames roared like a furnace blotting out the stars. The rising moon was full and ultimately hideous. Sometimes the smoke masked it, but all too often that bulging dragon's eye swam free and peered down, casting a bleary orange light. Clay thought it a horror comic moon, but didn't say so. No one had much to say. The people on the bridge only looked at the city they had so lately left, watching as the flames reached the pricey harborfront condos and began engulfing them. From across the water came an interwoven tapestry of alarms, fire alarms and car alarms mostly, with several whooping sirens added for spice. For a while, an amplified voice had told citizens to get off the streets, and then another had begun advising them to leave the city on foot by major arteries west and north. These two contradictory pieces of advice had competed with each other for several minutes, and then get off the streets had ceased. About 5 minutes later, leave the city on foot had also quit. Now there was only the hungry roar of the wind-driven fire, the alarms, and a steady low crumping sound that Clay thought must be windows imploding in the enormous heat. He wondered how many people had been trapped over there, trapped between the fire and the water. "Remember wondering if a modern city could burn?" Tom McCourt said. In the light of the fire, his small, intelligent face looked tired and sick. There was a smudge of ash on one of his cheeks. "Remember that?" "Shut up, come on," Alice said. She was clearly distraught, but like Tom, she spoke in a low voice. "It's like we're in a library," Clay thought. And then he thought, no, a funeral home. "Can't we please go, because this is kicking my ass?"
"Sure," Clay said, "you bet. How far to your place, Tom?"
"From here? Less than 2 miles," he said. "But it's not all behind us, I'm sorry to say." They had turned north now, and he pointed ahead and to the right. The glow blooming there could almost have been orange-tinted arc-sodium streetlights on a cloudy night, except the night was clear, and the streetlights were now out. In any case, streetlights did not give off rising columns of smoke. Alice moaned, then covered her mouth as if she expected someone among the silent multitude watching Boston burn might reprimand her for making too much noise.
"Don't worry," Tom said with eerie calm. "We're going to Malden, and that looks like Revere. The way the wind's blowing, Malden should still be all right."
"Stop right there," Clay urged him silently, but Tom did not.
"For now," he added.
Chapter 2. There were several dozen abandoned cars on the lower deck of the span, and a fire truck with East Boston lettered on its avocado green side that had been sideswiped by a cement truck. Both were abandoned, but mostly this level of the bridge belonged to the pedestrians.
"Except now you probably have to call them refugees," Clay thought, and then realized there was no them about it.
"Us. Call us refugees." There was still very little talk. Most people just stood and watched the city burn in silence. Those who were moving went slowly, looking back frequently over their shoulders. Then, as they neared the far end of the bridge, he could see Old Ironsides, at least he thought it was Old Ironsides, riding at anchor in the harbor, still safe from the flames. He noticed an odd thing. Many of them were also looking at Alice. At first, he had the paranoid idea that people must think he and Tom had abducted the girl and were spiriting her away for God knew what immoral purposes. Then he had to remind himself that these wraiths on the Mystic Bridge were in shock, even more uprooted from their normal lives than the Hurricane Katrina refugees had been. Those unfortunates had at least had some warning, and were unlikely to be capable of considering such fine ideas. Most were too deep in their own heads for moralizing. Then the moon rose a little higher and came out a little more strongly, and he got it. She was the only adolescent in sight.
Even Clay himself was young compared to most of their fellow refugees. The majority of people gawking at the torch that had been Boston, or plodding slowly toward Malden and Danvers, were over 40, and many looked eligible for the Golden Ager discount at Denny's. He saw a few people with little kids, and a couple of babies in strollers, but that was pretty much it for the younger set. A little farther on, he noticed something else. There were cell phones lying discarded in the roadway. Every few feet they passed another one, and none were whole. They had either been run over or stomped down to nothing but wire and splinters of plastic, like dangerous snakes that had been destroyed before they could bite again. Chapter 3.
"What's your name, dear?"
asked a plump woman who came angling across to their side of the highway. This was about 5 minutes after they had left the bridge. Tom said another 15 would bring them to the Salem Street exit, and from there it was only 4 blocks to his house. He said his cat would be awfully glad to see him, and that had brought a wan smile to Alice's face. Clay thought wan was better than nothing. Now Alice looked with reflexive mistrust at the plump woman who had detached herself from the mostly silent groups and little lines of men and women, hardly more than shadows, really, some with suitcases, some carrying shopping bags or wearing backpacks, that had crossed the Mystic and were walking north on Route 1, away from the Great Fire to the south, and all too aware of the new one taking hold in Revere, off to the northeast. The plump woman looked back at her with sweet interest. Her graying hair was done in neat beauty shop curls. She wore cat's eye glasses and what Clay's mother would have called a car coat. She carried a shopping bag in one hand and a book in the other. There seemed to be no harm in her. She certainly wasn't one of the phone crazies. They hadn't seen a single one of those since leaving the Atlantic Avenue Inn with their sacks of grub. But Clay felt himself go on point, just the same.
To be approached as if they were at a get-acquainted tea instead of fleeing a burning city
didn't seem normal. But under these circumstances, just what was? He was probably losing it. But if so, Tom was too. He was also watching the plump, motherly woman with go-away eyes.
"Alice?"
Alice said at last, just when Clay had decided the girl wasn't going to reply at all. She sounded like a kid trying to answer what she fears may be a trick question in a class that's really too tough for her.
"My name is Alice Maxwell."
"Alice," the plump woman said, and her lips curved in a maternal smile, as sweet as her look of interest. There was no reason that smile should have set Clay on edge more than he already was, but it did.
"That's a lovely name. It means blessed of God."
"Actually, ma'am, it means of the royalty, or regally born," Tom said. "Now, could you excuse us? The girl has just lost her mother today, and
we've all lost someone today, haven't we, Alice?"
the plump woman said without looking at Tom. She kept pace with Alice, her beauty shop curls bouncing with every step. Alice was eyeing her with a mixture of unease and fascination. Around them, others paced and sometimes hurried, and often plodded with their heads down, little more than wraiths in this unaccustomed darkness. And Clay still saw nobody young except for a few babies, a few toddlers, and Alice. No adolescents, because most adolescents had cell phones, like Pixie Light back at the Mr. Softy truck, or like his own son, who had a red Nextel with a ringtone from the Monster Club, and a teacher worker mommy who might be with him, or might be just about any...
"Stop it. Don't you let that rat out. That rat can do nothing but run, bite, and chase its own tail."
The plump woman, meanwhile, kept nodding. Her curls bounced along.
"Yes, we've all lost someone. But this is the time of the great tribulation. It's all in here, in Revelation."
She held up the book she was carrying, and of course it was a Bible. And now Clay thought he was getting a better look at the sparkle in the eyes behind the plump woman cat's eye glasses. That wasn't kindly interest. That was lunacy.
"Oh, that's it. Everybody out of the pool," Tom said.
In his voice, Clay heard a mixture of disgust at himself for letting the plump woman bore in and get close to begin with, quite likely, and dismay. The plump woman took no notice, of course. She had fixed Alice with her stare, and who was there to pull her away. The police were otherwise occupied, if there were any left. Here there were only the shocked and shuffling refugees, and they could care less about one elderly, crazy lady with a Bible and a beauty shop perm.
The vial of insanity has been poured into the brains of the wicked, and the city of sin has been set afire by the cleansing torch of Jehovah, the plump lady cried.
She was wearing red lipstick. Her teeth were too even to be anything but old-fashioned dentures.
Now you see the unrepentant flee, yea, verily, even as maggots flee the burst belly of—
Alice put her hands over her ears.
Make her stop, she cried.
And still the ghost shapes of the city's recent residents filed past, only a few sparing a dull, incurious glance before looking once more into the darkness, where somewhere ahead New Hampshire lay. The plump woman was starting to work up a sweat, Bible raised, eyes blazing, beauty shop curls nodding and swaying.
Take your hands down, girl, and hear the word of God before you let these men lead you away and fornicate with you in the open doorway of hell itself. For I saw a star blaze in the sky, and it was called Wormwood, and those that followed it followed upon Lucifer, and those that followed upon Lucifer walked downward into the furnace of—
Clay hit her. He pulled the punch at the last second, but it was still a solid clip to the jaw, and he felt the impact travel all the way up to his shoulder. The plump woman's glasses rose off her pug nose and then settled back. Behind them, her eyes lost their glare and rolled up in their sockets. Her knees came unhinged, and she buckled, her Bible tumbling from her clenched fist. Alice, still looking stunned and horrified, nevertheless dropped her hands from her ears fast enough to catch the Bible, and Tom McCourt caught the woman under her arms. The punch and the two subsequent catches were so neatly done, they could have been choreographed. Clay was suddenly closer to undone than at any time since things had started going wrong. Why this should have been worse than the throat-biting teenage girl or the knife-wielding businessman, worse than finding Mr. Riccardi hanging from a light fixture with a bag over his head, he didn't know, but it was. He had kicked the knife-wielding businessman, Tom had too, but the knife-wielding businessman had been a different kind of crazy. The old lady with the beauty shop curls had just been a—
Jesus, he said. She was just a nut, and I cold-cocked her.
He was starting to shake.
She was terrorizing a young girl who lost her mother today, Tom said,
and Clay realized it wasn't calmness he heard in the small man's voice, but an extraordinary coldness.
You did exactly the right thing. Besides, you can't keep an old iron horse like this down for long. She's coming around already.
Help me get her over to the side of the road. Chapter 4. They had reached the part of Route 1, sometimes called the Miracle Mile, sometimes Sleaze Alley, where limited access highway yielded to a jostle of liquor marts, cut-rate clothing stores, sporting goods outlets, and eateries with names like Fuddruckers. Here the six lanes were littered, if not quite choked, with vehicles that had either been piled up or just abandoned when their operators panicked, tried their cell phones, and went insane. The refugees wove their various courses silently among the remains, reminding Clay Riddell more than a little of ants evacuating a hill that had been demolished by the careless passing bootstride of some heedless human. There was a green reflectorized sign reading, Malden, Salem Street Exit, 1/4 mile,
at the edge of a low pink building that had been broken into.
It was fronted by a jagged skirting of broken glass, and a battery-powered burglar alarm was even now in the tired last stages of running down. A glance at the dead sign on the roof was all Clay needed to tell him what had made the place a target in the aftermath of the day's disaster. Mr. Biggs' Giant Discount Liquor. He had one of the plump woman's arms, Tom had the other, and Alice supported the muttering woman's head as they eased her to a sitting position with her back against one of the exit sign's legs. Just as they got her down, the plump woman opened her eyes and looked at them dazedly. Tom snapped his finger in front of her eyes twice, briskly. She blinked, then turned her eyes to Clay.
You hit me, she said.
Her fingers rose to touch the rapidly puffing spot on her jaw. Yes, I'm sorry, Clay began. He may be, but I'm not, Tom said. He spoke with that same cold briskness. You were terrorizing our ward. The plump woman laughed softly, but tears were in her eyes.
Ward? I've heard a lot of words for it, but never that one. As if I don't know what men like you want with a tender girl like this, especially in times like these. They repented not their fornications, nor their sodomies, nor their—
Shut up, Tom said, or I'll hit you myself. And unlike my friend, who was, I think, lucky enough not to grow up among the holy Hannahs and thus does not recognize you for what you are, I won't pull my punch. Fair warning, one more word.
He held his fist before her eyes, and although Clay had already concluded that Tom was an educated man, civilized, and probably not much of a puncher under ordinary circumstances, he could not help feeling dismay at the sight of that small, tight fist, as if he were looking at an omen of the coming age. The plump lady looked and said nothing. One large tear spilled down her rouged cheek.
That's enough, Tom. I'm okay, Alice said.
Tom dropped the plump lady's shopping bag of possessions into her lap. Clay hadn't even realized Tom had salvaged it. Then Tom took the Bible from Alice, picked up one of the plump lady's beringed hands, and smacked the Bible into it, spine first. He started away, then turned back.
Tom, that's enough. Let's go, Clay said.
Tom ignored him. He bent toward the woman sitting with her back against the sign's leg. His hands were on his knees, and to Clay, the two of them, the plump, spectacled woman looking up, the small, spectacled man bending over with his hands on his knees, looked like figures in some lunatic's parody of the early illustrations from the Charles Dickens novels.
Some advice, sister, Tom said. The police will no longer protect you as they did when you and your self-righteous, holy-rolling friends marched on the family planning centers or the Emily Cathcart Clinic in Waltham. That abortion mill, she spat, and then raised her Bible as if to block a blow.
Tom didn't hit her, but he was smiling grimly.
I don't know about the vial of insanity, but there's certainly beaucoup crazy making the rounds tonight. May I be clear? The lions are out of their cages, and you may well find that they'll eat the mouthy Christians first. Somebody canceled your right of free speech around 3 o'clock this afternoon. Just a word to the wise.
He looked from Alice to Clay, and Clay saw that the upper lip beneath the mustache was trembling slightly.
Shall we go?
Yes, Clay said.
Wow,
Alice said, once they were walking toward the Salem Street ramp again, Mr. Big's giant discount liquor falling behind them.
You grew up with someone like that?
My mother and both of her sisters, Tom said. First New England Church of Christ the Redeemer. They took Jesus as their personal savior, and the church took them as its personal pigeons. Where is your mother now? Clay asked. Tom glanced at him briefly.
Heaven.
Unless they rooked her on that one, too. I'm pretty sure the bastards did.
Chapter 5. Near the stop sign at the foot of the ramp, two men were fighting over a keg of beer. If forced to guess, Clay would have said it had probably been liberated from Mr. Big's giant discount liquor. Now it lay forgotten against the guardrails, dented and leaking foam, while the two men, both brawny and both bleeding, battered each other with their fists. Alice shrank against him, and Clay put his arm around her, but there was something almost reassuring about these brawlers. They were angry, enraged, but not crazy. Not like the people back in the city. One of them was bald and wearing a Celtics jacket. He hit the other a looping overhand blow that mashed his opponent's lips and knocked him flat. When the man in the Celtics jacket advanced on the downed man scrambled away, then got up, still backing off. He spat blood.
Take it, you fuck!
He yelled in a thick, weepy Boston accent. Hope it chokes ya! The bald man in the Celtics jacket made as if to charge him, and the other went running up the ramp toward Route 1. Celtics jacket started to bend down for his prize, registered Clay, Alice, and Tom, and straightened up again. It was 3-1. He had a black eye and blood was trickling down the side of his face from a badly torn earlobe, but Clay saw no fear in that face, although he had only the diminishing light of the Revere fire to go by.
He thought his grandfather would have said the guy's Irish was up, and certainly that went with the big green shamrock on the back of his jacket.
"The fuck you looking at?"
he asked. "Nothing. Just going by you, if that's all right," Tom said mildly. "I live on Salem Street."
"You can go to Salem Street or hell, far as I'm concerned," the bald man in the Celtics jacket said. "Still a free country, isn't it?"
"Tonight?" Clay said. "Too free." The bald man thought it over and then laughed, a humorless double ha-ha.
"The fuck happened? Any of yous know?"
Alice said, "It was the cell phones. They made people crazy." The bald man picked up the keg. He handled it easily, tipping it so the leak stopped.
"Fucking things," he said.
"Never cared to own one.
Roll over minutes, the fuck are those?"
Clay didn't know. Tom might have. He'd owned a cell phone, so it seemed possible, but Tom said nothing. Probably didn't want to get into a long discussion with the bald man, and probably a good idea. Clay thought the bald man had some of the characteristics of an unexploded grenade.
"City burning?"
the bald man asked.
"Is, isn't it?"
"Yes," Clay said. "I don't think the Celtics will be playing at the Fleet this year."
"They ain't shit anyway," the man said. "Doc Rivers couldn't coach a pal team."
He stood watching them, the keg on his shoulder, blood running down the side of his face. Yet now he seemed peaceable enough, almost serene.
"Go on," he said. "But I wouldn't stay this close to the city for long. It's going to get worse before it gets better. It's going to be a lot more fires, for one thing. You think everybody who hightailed at North remembered to turn off the gas stove? I fucking doubt it."
The three of them started walking, then Alice stopped. She pointed to the keg.
"Was that yours?"
The bald man looked at her reasonably.
"Ain't no was at times like this, sweetie pie. Ain't no was left. There's just now and maybe tomorrow. It's mine now. And if there's any left, it'll be mine maybe tomorrow. Go on now. The fuck out."
"See ya," Clay said, and raised one hand.
"Wouldn't want to be ya,"
the bald man replied, unsmiling, but he raised his own hand in return. They had passed the stop sign and were crossing to the far side of what Clay assumed was Salem Street when the bald man called after them again.
"Hey, handsome!"
Both Clay and Tom turned to look, then glanced at each other, amused. The bald guy with the keg was now only a dark shape on the rising ramp. He could have been a caveman carrying a club.
"Where are the loonies now?" the bald guy asked. "You're not going to tell me they're all dead, are you? Because I don't fucking believe it."
"That's a very good question," Clay said.
"You're fucking A right it is. Watch out for the little sweetie pie there."
And without waiting for them to reply, the man who'd won the battle of the beer keg turned and merged with the shadows.